I want to remind everyone about the remaining events connected to Yochai's visit. This evening at 7:30, there is a reception with pleasant goodies, warm fire and drink at my house. That's 1101 Grant Street, and everybody who wants to come is invited. You don't have to be an insider in the inner circles in sociology or the Haven Center. Undergraduates are absolutely welcome to come as well. It's walking distance from campus, so that's 1101 Grant Street, corner of Grant and Adams, at 7:30. Then this evening, tomorrow at 12:20, is that our official?
That's an official time.
Yeah.
It doesn't really fit with a normal Friday schedule.
Yeah, Fridays actually are, 12:20 is a Tuesday, Thursday, noon
maybe
slot.
Maybe we need it noon. Did we make it noon?
I guess it's 12:20.
12:20, so whatever. 12-ish.
Open, arrive early.
The open forum discussion to pursue the themes of the two lectures and any other related matters that people want to talk about. The idea of the Friday discussion is really to have a couple of hours for free-floating conversations around the themes that have been laid out by Haven Center visitors. It's not structured as an additional presentation, but it is a chance for a much more informal and often extremely lively and productive discussion. So, again, any of you who are animated by these ideas of a digital economy and an emancipatory future through a commons-based peer production cooperative world and want to explore those themes, do come tomorrow afternoon. So, without further introduction, Yochai.
Thanks again. Yesterday, I tried to do two things. First, lay out the claim about the economic determinants of the relatively larger role of social cooperation in the information economy. And then to extract from that an approach toward cooperative human systems design applied offline as well as online as a general approach to designing systems of interaction among people based on assumptions of a more diverse motivational profile than the rational actor model that has dominated much of systems design in the last 40, 50 years. What I'll try to do today is two things. The first is to make more explicit than I did in the 2006 book the role of power and to begin to offer a way of describing power in social relations in the same mode that I did in trying to explain it in liberal theory, in liberal political theory, in terms that can be converted to liberal and standard behavioral sciences language so as to create a transition between critical work that focuses on power in society and human behavior studies and economics and modes of analysis that are easily translatable to a wide range of discourses in contemporary American and European discourse. And this I do, as we had a conversation a little bit yesterday in the seminar, as a matter of an effort to create an analytic framework that is very broadly accessible to a wide range of methodological and political viewpoints, as opposed to something that's discreetly left and critical. The second thing that I'll do in the second half of today's talk is begin to raise the questions about how utopian this utopianism is and what are the limits and to what extent we need to be worried. And I already started to raise the flags yesterday when I talked about Amazon Mechanical Turk and Threadless and about the possibility of capture and undermining of this path. Because at no point have I made a deterministic claim about the benevolent future, but rather that there's a conflict between different ways of organizing the world and life. And possibilities, but also risks. So let me start with power, and let me start by telling a story that I already told in Chapter 7 of the 2006 book Much of the rest won't be repetition of what I said, but this is a particularly useful example. So if you look today at at the company Diebold, you won't find this, which is what you found in 2002 on their site. A major part of their business was selling election systems. If you look today, you'll find all sorts of different things about ATMs, but nothing about voting systems. It's all been outsourced to a subsidiary called Premier, where you'll find nowhere a relationship to Diebold. What's the story behind this? As some of you may remember, in 2000, we had a bit of an issue with presidential election tallying. And so by 2002, there was an effort to introduce electronic voting as a way to solve the hanging chads problem. And there were some concerns that were raised. And when you look at reports, the first state that did this was Georgia. When you looked at reports in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, as well as the New York Times and other places, the structure of the conversation was always the same. Some people raised concerns about electronic voting, but person A, whom we spoke to, said that these systems were well-tested and worked well, and person B said that the company was always ready to support if there would be any problems, and person A was the company vendor, and person B was the state official who bought the machine from the company, and all was well. There was, however, one activist, Bev Harris, who was less than completely pleased with this and got source code. How it was leaked is not entirely clear, but what she did was she put it on blackboxvoting.org, a site, and then it was also picked up in Scoop in New Zealand, that placed a different model of analysis. If you imagine that the traditional model of watchdog in the mainstream, in the mass media environment, the ideal case was Pentagon Papers, right? So you've got insider knowledge gets transmitted from Ellsberg to the New York Times that uses its money to put two reporters reading the materials, analyzing them, and then publishing. And when the government tries to shut them down, they hand it over to the Washington Post. And when the government tries to shut them down, they use all of the money that they have from being such a powerful company to hire a top First Amendment lawyer to run all the way to the Supreme Court. The First Amendment steps in, forces the revelation of the Pentagon Papers, and changes the result. The system is a system that relies on the relative concentrated power of the New York Times on one hand, its dependence on market as opposed to state as its source of funding on the other, to provide it the means by which it goes to law as the source and an independent judiciary that forces through the First Amendment revelation and the watchdog function. That's the model that we see of the 20th century First Amendment model based on major, powerful, market-based media as the watchdog over a government. This model is very different. This model, this is from Scoop at the time. First of all, it's not trust us, we had two reporters in an office looking at it. We now have the physical information, make them available on websites and file sharing networks in case they get shut down. Now, some of these may be password protected, but here are these nice people from lostpasswords.com. They can help you with that. Some of these may be corrupted, but here are these nice people from ZipRepair. Why don't you use their utility? And we can't pay anyone to analyze this, but it's really important. It's the new war game. If you find anything, let us know here in this forum. See for yourself, collaborate on trying to analyze, communicate to each other, and we'll move this forward. indeed, this is what happens to a great extent. Some of the people who review include a group led by Abby Rubin at Johns Hopkins, because it's a university center that focuses on security and shows holes. There's media exposure, Diebold has to respond, Maryland requires a review and studies and then modification in the system. Bev Harris then becomes another source, so that when you have an anonymous whistleblower who finds a cache of internal company emails, that whistleblower essentially sends to one, to Wired, which is the closest thing in this case to a mass media outlet. And Wired writes a story and says, can you believe these guys lost their stuff again? First they use their source code, now they lose their emails, and that's it. Harris puts it on black box voting, same story, except for one thing. At this point, Diebold sends a Digital Millennium Copyright Act notice, a DMCA notice, to Harris's ISP, Internet Service Provider, and says the ISP will be liable for copyright infringement of the emails, of the content of the emails, unless they shut down Harris. So they shut her down. But we've already seen the technique introduced, which was go cache it, right? So what's the statement here? If you look at the technique, as we anticipate attempts to prevent the distribution of this information, we encourage supporters of democracy to make copies of these files and to make them available on websites and file sharing networks. This is in 2002. And indeed, this is what a few students at Swarthmore do. But Diebold already knows how to deal with this, so they send Swarthmore a copyright violation. So now what's interesting here is that you take a system originally designed, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, to control distribution, to solve problems of Hollywood and the recording industry and their model, transposed into a system that's in an effort to shut down whistleblowing, and then metastasizing to control the relationship between a university and its students completely in a different context to shut down. So an effort to leverage one system designed for one purpose to control and change the relationship of an educational system in the other direction. That should end everything, except, of course, it doesn't. Instead, what you get is that the students replicate the materials by other users on other campuses, but also introduce them into Freenet, which is itself a pre-Napster peer-to-peer network optimized for censorship resistance, primarily originally used for China, but also Overnet, that is to say a peer-to-peer file sharing network, which has both proprietary clients and free software clients, and Freenet itself is free software. So what we see is an ecosystem that combines commercial and non-commercial, open source and proprietary, legal and illegal activities, all combining to create a resistant ecology that prevents censorship of the materials. Now, law is not entirely irrelevant. The students did, in fact, bring a declaratory judgment against Diebold to say, this is illegal for you, it's an illegal use under the First Amendment for you to shut us up using copyright. And they win. But they win 1 year later. Too late to have had an effect on the election. Instead, what we actually saw was that while the emails were still being supposedly illegally circulating, the California State Election Commission suddenly comes across evidence in the emails that suggests that the Diebold actually was deploying software that was not certified by the state, decertified a huge portion of the machines and had them changed and adapted, all in time for the election, which would not have been had they relied on the alternative model. So if you compare this to the story I told you about the Pentagon Papers, you see two very different systems of watchdog in terms of who performs the watchdog, how independence from potential shutdown by the state or by private parties occurs, and it happens through redundant capabilities, decentralized in a way that is practically impossible to control, through a combination of both legal and illegal, commercial and non-commercial, proprietary and non-proprietary techniques. In this context, to a great extent, what we see is freedom as bobbing and weaving between systems of constraint and affordance that allow individuals or groups to dodge the power plays of some and exert their own power in pursuit of their own goals. And we'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by loose coupling. But essentially, loose coupling is the extent to which being inside a system determines the outcome of the interaction through that system, or the extent to which a system has enough freedom of action within the system so that even though you can use its affordances, it doesn't necessarily determine the outcome. And in this regard, the net was the more loosely coupled system than the mass mediated system that depended on the Supreme Court to come in and ride into the rescue. Without that, you could shut down the system. and whether or not you have an open system, that is to say, a system where there are symmetric constraints between different players, and you can shift from one system to another, so that when you move from the commercial ISP that supported Ben Harris to the university, out to the other systems as well as the P2P network, all of these were available for these data to replicate themselves across other places. So what do I mean by power, and what's the definition that I'll be using? I'm talking about the capacity of one entity to alter the behaviors, configurations, or outcomes of others, measured in terms of probabilities of deviation from a baseline preferred behavior, configuration, or outcome. So an agent A1 can be said to have power over A2 or another agent to the extent that A1 can act in a way that increases the probability that A2 will behave B1, that is to say the way A1 prefers C1 or O1, obviously, rather than B2, that is to say behave as A2 would have preferred before the interaction or had the configuration to or outcome to. I'm using this, and I'm backing it out of the way in which economists define market power. Again, it's a translation mechanism between what would be recognizable to a critical analysis of power that is about one party being able to control others systematically, and a framework that still recognizes the idea of preferences, principles, and policies that are self-driven, whether it's preferences in economics, principles or policies in terms of liberal theory more generally of choice, and provides a framework in which to begin to also explain, once we talk about not only behaviors, but also preferences, to bring in the question of cultural power and the ability to shape preferences. And I'll dig a little deeper into that in a couple of minutes. Let me just evoke again from what I talked about yesterday with regard to integrated system, talking about human actions and conditions played out within the affordances and constraints of multiple subsystems that intersect as dimensions of force acting on a set of behaviors and outcomes in context. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about a political system that moves the forces of the state, and the question of the extent to which we have new ways of moving the political system and exerting power over the network public sphere, over the ability to communicate against and argue against someone. So Castells is now calling it mass self-communication. Industrial organization, modalities of production, daily life, and fabrication of context. This is all of what I was talking about yesterday in the second half. Culture and meaning making, I talked about it some yesterday, I'll talk about it a lot more today in a couple of minutes. Institutional, the degree to which we actually have more commons or more property and how that works, and the technical platforms of design, again, we talked about that more yesterday. So the idea is to imagine individuals operating at an intersection of these integrated systems and having ability to do things and not to do things, affordances and constraints that are determined by the sum total of forces operating within each of these systems. And in trying to analyze the degree to which a particular person or group of people are more or less free or more or less susceptible to the power of others, we need to look at the intersection of all of these forces. So in the Diebold story, we had a legal force for a certain period constraining behavior by attacking particular strategic places that were previously used by the A2s, in that case, the students or Ben Harris, and trying to shut those down using law to shut down the technical system and make it more constrained. However, the design of the technical system was such that the users were able to shift to a different system that was less susceptible to control, and therefore the technical system allowed them a certain freedom until the legal system switched in the other direction. And so essentially being able to shift between systems and use the affordances of one system, in that case the P2P network, a particular implementation of the technical system, is what permitted the freedom, rather than the internal constraints within the system of law of First Amendment versus copyright, etc. So it was actually the freedom to shift between systems, and that's what's critical for me to get around. The relative openness between systems and the ability to shift within a system from a technical system that assumes an ISP to a technical system that has a P2P framework that allow for that particular freedom of behavior. And I'll do more of this, and I'll repeat this when we come back to culture in a minute or two. For some reason, this is projecting poorly, but I'll go through. Part of what I'm trying to do is translate work done by a legal scholar named Wesley Hofeld about 100 years ago. And Hofeld was trying to be very crisp about what it means to have a right and what it means to be bound by a duty, what it means to have a privilege and what it means to have somebody else not have a duty. And I'm generalizing from here, from him. If we imagine power as power is always relational, someone has power, the other person has susceptibility. To say that someone has freedom is essentially to say that someone else has no power. What that means is that we can't define power and susceptibility or freedom except in relation between potential agent or actants trying to control the other. And this is along multiple dimensions of both behavior, both in terms of preferences, principles, policies, and actions, as well as outcomes and configuration. And by configuration, I essentially mean power or freedom regarding who has power over whom, through what mechanisms and pathways in a given system. Both power within the system, and this goes to the question of the loose coupling, and power between systems, or the extent to which you can move in and out of the system for the particular interaction, or the extent to which once an interaction is controlled by a system, it's completely controlled by that system. So what's an example of this? Actually, I'll give some more examples, and that I hope will make things clearer. So here's an example. Prince moves to sue websites. Fan sites dedicated to Prince say they've been served legal notice to remove all images of the singer, his lyrics, and anything linked to Prince's likeness. Okay, so that's a move that's typical of the technique of the recording industry in the last 15 years or so, which is essentially to look at the potentials of digital distribution of music and to try to use the legal system to control the ways in which the technological system structures the way in which fans interact with music. So, again, in the context of dimensions of power, what we have is, in the early 1990s, mobilization of political power through lobbying to pass laws like the Non-Electronic Theft Act, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, in particular those two, which in turn strengthen institutional power through ratcheting up the extent of property rights, criminalizing the sharing of files well beyond what was true before 1998. So before 1998, you had to essentially be a commercial producer of exact copies in order to violate copyright criminally. After 1998, it was enough that you shared a lot of files, even if all you did was you shared files and others shared them back with you, to be criminal. So a strong emphasis on criminal enforcement, strong technological constraint through digital rights management and digital locks and encryption, industrial organization with the structure of the recording industry around highly capitalized record labels, production and marketing and the fan system, and an effort here, and you see in Prince's saying, you can't use my likeness in any way, to maintain cultural meaning-making of the particular artist as a one-way control system. You have to see me the way I project myself to you. An effort to have across multiple systems the ability to control what it means to be a fan of Prince. Now, it's important to remember that property as an institution depends on asymmetric power. The reason that it depends on asymmetric power is that markets are mechanisms by which you come to the person who has that asymmetric power and buy them off in terms of the ability to act. If there weren't asymmetric power with one person having the power to say yes and another no, you wouldn't know whom to pay. You wouldn't be able to function in the market. Asymmetric power is central to how property functions. And it's important to recognize that property is a mechanism for devolving the power of the state to to non-state actors so they can deploy it over resources. That is to say, what makes property property is the threat the sheriff will come after you if you take it from me. It doesn't exist without the state. And what it does, though, is it distributes the power to call on the state throughout the population, so then you can have a market function around permissions to act without me calling the sheriff. But power turns out to be not one-dimensional in this system. Turns out that fans can push back. And so we see fans pushing on institutional power through property by actually ignoring it, or pushing back on technology by idealizing hackers who help break the technology, and pushing back on cultural meaning-making and the social practices and norms of fan culture. So, for example, just even in the same story, we see that fans have vowed to fight what they say was censorship. The move was a shock to many of his followers, etc. So already you see a cultural argument over the degree of legitimacy and stability of the claim that I can control by invoking, calling the supposed private power by its name that we call it for public power, which is censorship, and trying to destabilize that distinction between property and state power. So again, we see the state putting these federal these anti-piracy warnings and trying to say, I will criminalize this. But we see cultural adoption of the term pirate as cool. And the resistance of the idea that piracy is in fact illegitimate. And we see the industry itself not being particularly good at staying on message when it tells us that piracy is really cool and sexy. In any event, there has to be a better way than this particular model of trying to control. And what I want to do now is spend a few minutes describing to you a study that a few students of mine and I have just finished, looking at how some artists now are actually using very different dimensions of power to create an alternative, sustainable model of music production that doesn't depend on the legal and technical forcing constraints, but rather shifts to a social system of cooperation. So the best known example of this is not something we actually studied because it's too well known, essentially. This is Trent Reznor trying. So you had the in 2007, the inevitable rise and liberation of Digi Tardas, failure at 18%, right? Only 18% actually paid for the album that was otherwise released freely. But still, 140,000 direct artist revenue, more than the artist had made in prior normal channels, something that would have required $1 million worth of sale to recover that much for the artist, because we're in a context in which the artist receives all of the revenues directly online instead of through the traditional organizational model. Reznor learns the lesson and now ends up the Nine Inch Nails later released Ghosts 1 to 4 for a variety of a free download, $5 download. The free download is only 9 tracks. This is in higher quality and more. Various kinds of CD sets, a $75 deluxe set, a $300 ultra deluxe set, a variety of different affordances that include free. And what you get in the first year, the first week, is $1.6 million from 781 transactions in the first week after release. And today you're seeing Reznor expanding to various downloads for iPhone and iPod, etc. Most importantly, an introduction to remix.nin.com and an introduction to basically say, let's make meaning together, culturally. Not just I'm telling you, but we're making together. What Leah Belsky, Byron Carr, Max Berkelhammer, and I did was look at a few sort of mid-level and unknown artists and look at data over time that have been for several years trying these kinds of approaches. And so this is data on single MP3 downloads in terms of what people were paying. This describes the 25th to 75th percentile of contributions. This is a context that, and I'll explain in a minute, that doesn't have a required payment at all, a required transaction at all. So in some sense, it's the lowest load. What we see from 3.5 years is that you see a relatively similar pattern to what you see in the industry. Right after the release of an album, a lot of payment goes down. This is a context in which just after Radiohead released their album for free, there was a lot of media attention to her, which was why there was new interest. And here there's another release of another album. Now, hers was the system that was least well designed from the cooperative human systems design that I talked about yesterday for a variety of reasons that I'll talk about for about a minute, in a minute. But first of all, let's see how poorly this did. The first thing is, even though it was a purely voluntary donation model with all sorts of ambiguous messages, 22% of people who downloaded music actually paid. When they paid an average of $1.25 per track, as opposed and $9 per album, as opposed to a $0.99 industry practice in the forced payment model. So you're looking again, just as you saw with even the failed supposed experiment of Nicky Cardos, the artist coming home with more than they do in the traditional industrial model. What are the complications? So some things clearly fit the model of cooperative human systems design. An explicit statement of morality. This store model is based on the belief that people are good, in trust our best outcomes, our best comes forward, full forth, etc. But there are also mixed messages. So she calls it a store. She anchors it in a market price. She calls it a market price instead of calling it, as we'll see, in magnitude normal. She talks about average donation. She gives a pay later option that essentially gets used by a lot of people who feel like they don't want to explicitly not pay, but then they don't pay. They say pay later and they forget. So there's a whole lot of ways in which she's lowering the emotional load on people to actually contribute. And nonetheless, you get 22% payment. A little bit on the industrial model. The industry model of forced payment, the industry claims, as of 2009, something like 95% of songs are still, 95% of downloads are still illegal, and only 5% are paid. So if you take the industry's claims at its face value, then of 100 songs downloaded, about 5 songs are paid for at the industry standard of 99 cents. Total revenue is $5. The industry takes about 4. The artist takes about 1. Now, if you take voluntary payment, even in this least well-designed of the three that we'll look at, of 100 songs downloaded, you're looking at an average price that will get you $25, of which the artist will take 20 and pay 5 for overhead. So you're looking at a model at which, even though it doesn't force payment, the artist goes home with a higher return and able to make a better living. This is a different site called Magnitude, and they've now shifted completely to subscription. So this is no longer their model. But nonetheless, we have 5.5 years of data. And again, what you get is a fairly stable contribution over years of $8 per album payments. Again, what's critical here is the albums are released under Creative Commons license, so it is legal to copy and give to your friends. The albums are released in a non-DRM format, so it is technically feasible, and yet you get payment. And in fact, what you see here that's very crisp is that in the design, there's a pull-down menu that tells you what the minimum payment, the typical, the better than average, generous, very very generous, and we love you. 48% of people over 5 years gave what was noted as typical, $8 per album. Now, just in case you think there's a smooth distribution, only 0.34% gave 8.5. Only 16% gave the minimum, which is roughly the same as those who gave better than average and generous. Again, very strong response to normative claims. All of this is essentially voluntary payment because it is legal and technically feasible to share. So that essentially what these sites are doing is moving from a system that combines law and technology to try to exercise unilateral power and control the payment, they're self-consciously abjuring those powers and saying, I'm not taking this power. It's not that it's not copyrighted, but I'm licensing it to you freely. It's not that I can't encrypt it, but I'm handing it over in the high format without encryption, but in exchange, I expect for you to reciprocate in a cooperative system and pay so that I can make a living as an artist and you can enjoy my music. The last one we'll talk about is Jonathan Colton, who is a computer programmer turned musician, and who really combines all of these things together. Partly, it's certainly includes a store. Yes, you should buy things. Great idea. You can download it here and here and here. I'm best off if you download it here. Here are karaoke versions. Here are ringtones. There's merchandise. But this is embedded in, as I said, licensing of Creative Commons, licensing triggering reciprocity, and specific things that you're saying you should buy this, lowering the emotional load on the supposed piracy and stealing by specifically saying already stole it, putting it into a somewhat jocular relationship with buy a monkey or a banana. To pay for it. So essentially what you're doing is unilateral disarmament from the hard power and invocation of soft power and a dynamic of reciprocity. No less important, in terms of the industrial organization, what he does is demand me in your town. That is to say, you fans decide where you want me to perform. Set up enough people to come and I will come where you perform. So you're essentially part of the construction of the performance. And you're part of the construction of the performance also in the sense of here's the stuff you've created, here are the mashups that you've done to my music, here are the things you've done, and you get a community of people communicating around their own creations with the artist's music to become part of a single interaction, which then obviously they look to fund. Now, as a matter of economic sustainability, Colton in the last few years has been making enough just from the downloads, not from the performances, that he would have had to get something on the order of 600,000 to 700,000 iTunes downloads per year on the traditional model to replicate those revenues. That is to say, you'd have to be remarkably successful. Even though he's a relatively small-scale artist. So how does this look in practice?
I quit my day job a little over a year ago writing software, and it was a terrible mistake. Does anybody need somebody who knows how to write in VB? I'm kidding, I'm joking. You should all quit your jobs tomorrow. It's fantastic. Works out really well, you know. Anyway, so I wrote this song about my experiences as a software designer. And this is called Code Monkey.
So what comes now is a mashup of several different user videos.
Code Monkey, get up, get a coffee. Code Monkey, go to job. Code Monkey, have boring meeting. Boring manager, Rob. Rob said Code Monkey very diligent, but his output stink. His code not functional or elegant. What did Code Monkey think? Code Monkey think maybe manager want to write goddamn long in page himself. Code Monkey not saying out loud. Code Monkey not crazy, just proud. Code Monkey likes Beatles. Code Monkey likes to have a Mountain Dew. Code Monkey, very simple man, a big, warm, fuzzy, secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey, hang around.
Sorry. So there are more of these, and this is the final piece.
Music video for this song, in which she dances around in her dorm room. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, wearing in her apartment. Yeah. t-shirt.
So this is a mashup of mashups that Anderson and Ito did. But the point that I'm trying to get across with this is a very different dynamic in which you have self-conscious abjuring of the forcing vectors of the institutional and technological, while at the same time a reorganization of the industrial organization towards something in which fans and artists build together both the construction of meaning and the construction of the actual performance cycle under in a context in which the meaning of what happens is produced together and through social practices and norms of trust, of fairness, of moral, ethical engagement with each other, instead of through unilateral control, through systems based on technological control and state power assigned to an industrial model. Essentially, you see a shift from institutional and technical unilateral hard power to social soft power, with artists and fans trying to move together from a system in which the organizational infrastructure takes advantage of the artists and of the fans and has enormous extractive capacity. So the per employee revenue in 2002 of the recording industry was about $500,000 per employee, which was about double the per employee revenue of Hollywood or the software industry or the computer hardware industry. So enormously well designed to extract value from both the artists and the fans, and essentially these are systems in which the fans and the artists together are shifting away from systems of control to systems of essentially soft power and persuasion to build their alternative model. So part of the question is, what makes cooperation in sociality center, ethical engagement, soft power-based system more attractive than property normatively? Let's not forget that these kinds of social demands can be enormously controlled. You can imagine a situation, if you just look at Marx on the Jewish question, basically the role of property and contract in liberating from heavily socially controlled feudal relations. Right? In context, a certain formality and break of social obligations that are obligations of subservience can be enormously liberating. What we have to say is that in the particular historical context of the 21st century, after a way in which property and contract and technical system control allowed for a certain application of power away from many people towards a relatively small number of capital-intensive enterprises, we can talk about these systems that are decentralized and based on social engagement and social norms as liberating relative to that baseline. Not forgetting that they too are a form of power that people apply to each other, and they too, in different contexts, can end up ossifying into relations of power that are unattractive. We're breaking them up into relations that are more atomized, more treating each other as just through property and contract, can end up being liberating. But in the context in which we exist, commons and network information environment offer pathways to route around late 20th century inequalities and modalities of domination. They provide an institutional, technical, organizational space in which to recognize each other's shared humanity. And essentially the absence of formal structures of control demands a space for mutual recognition that changes the dynamics of control to dynamics of mutual recognition. Let me try to map this. Let me try to map this, going relatively quickly through something that could easily spend an hour on by itself, but I won't. I'm repeating what I did yesterday, it would seem. But then it's not surprising, I always do this. If we look at different sources, different dimensions of power, technology, law, communications of cultural expression, expression of recognition and validation, expression of moral condemnation, marketing, competition dynamics, political lobbying, corporate acquisition, and standard-setting processes. What I'll try to do to you now is give you very minimal description of what systems went into controlling fan video of the kind that we saw using existing video from the 70s all the way to today. So essentially, if you're looking at fan video circa 1970, the technical affordances are all largely one way, except for a little bit of maybe what could be done with 8mm. Largely, you're talking about a one-way system with relatively few affordances, largely controlled through law, FCC law, and copyright law with regard to theaters and broadcasters, controlling who the movies can or can't do. And essentially, you get these three platforms, both technical and contractual, controlling to a great extent with a very minimal room for fan production. With the introduction of the VCR, we see a little more, we see the development of essentially a new platform that's closer to the home. We see a shift toward broadcasters and away from theaters to some extent as the core platforms. We see efforts in law to constrain this, but then the Supreme Court essentially creates a fair use exception for VCR developers that are then allowed to market them. We see major battles between movie studios and broadcasters through financial interest and syndication rules that end up placing more power in the broadcasters, and then result in the movie studios buying some of the stations to create their own WB and UPN channels, and Fox, obviously, first. And we see a little bit more, but not hugely more, development of fan culture around the fact that it's easier to send around videotapes than it was to send around 8mm. It's easier for people to actually produce things and cut and create their own. We see a big change and a big jump by the mid-90s, once you have digital copying feasible. The debates now shift towards standard setting, in particular DVD standard setting, where Congress, the movie studios leans on Congress and the White House. In the early 90s, we have enormous pressure on the then White House to develop a very strong digital protection regime that ends up in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, heavily sponsored by the Clinton administration and passed by the Gingrich Congress, an interesting alliance in that context. We see major debates over developing encryption. We see the emergence of a new electronic foundation type organization. We begin to see hacker culture pushing back and finding decryptions for the DVD encryption, which are sued by law, in this case, the U.S. getting the Norwegian authorities to clamp down on a Norwegian teenager that allows for decryption of DVDs. We see an American nonprofit organization trying to fight that fight and losing it, but we see an enormous increase in the glorification of hackers as the preservers of freedom in the digital environment. That feeds into a continuation of hacking of control, so as to make technical protection relatively weaker. And we're beginning to see a new set of platforms that enable fans to have much richer interactions with each other, and that are centered around the open platform of the net. As we move to the last 6 years with the introduction of YouTube, of social networks, but also the move to the iPhone and its particular role, what we see is a battle between different kinds of platforms. At one level, The cable companies and the telcos, particularly the cable companies, continue to be regular video distribution channels, but they also become the broadband providers to the home, and their platform now traverses both the internet-like platform that's controlled, and all of the debates over net neutrality end up being about the degree to which this platform can control effectively the flow of voice, video, particularly for the cable companies, video over the net. We see the cable companies now moving to see how they manage between these videos. Just now, we're in the middle of the question of the NBC Comcast takeover. That's an effort to extend the power of cable over video. But at the same time, we see increased effectiveness of the open network with IBM during this period, what we talked about yesterday, providing enormous legitimacy to free and open source software development that provides its own platform separately, and fan culture becomes celebrated even more, and in fact gets integrated into the production activities of some of the mainstream traditional producers who now see this as a way of keeping fans. So you have an incredibly unstable state in which you have a very rich fan culture that depends on a very open framework, nonetheless under attack from two primary sources. One, the debate over net neutrality and the ability of the cable industry to control the technical architecture, and two, the development of iPhone and the iPod and the iPhone as technical platforms that are adopted through the market, but nonetheless are highly controlled and proprietary in terms of their platform, and very different in the characteristics of control from what we saw in the net. So essentially we have a potential of a universe in which we have integrated, proprietary, controlled, professional, and beautiful systems based on contracts of, for example, the Bundesliga that gives exclusive to Deutsche Telekom and T-Mobile for their delivery of their football games. That ends that particular path. In the U.S., we saw a period during which Apple would not let Mark Fiori have an app with his tunes run on Apple iStore because they were worried that his cartoons were too offensive. But again, the point is not whether that's right or wrong. The point is that this is an architecture that, to the extent that it becomes the standard in which most internet access occurs, and that's an entirely plausible pathway, not through law, not through forcing, but through consumer adoption, it's a system that allows the firm in control to capture. Whether what we'll have is some continued replication of what we already know, a commons base from the physical transport in Wi-Fi networks through the device, the logical layer, and up through the content. And these are really the two potential ends of the spectrum with a wide range of possibilities in between. What I'm going to do now is shift to talk some more about the potential threats and limitations and possibilities on the political side. Those of you who, when I talked about the Diebold case, we're in the middle of one of our own right now, right? It's WikiLeaks. What's interesting about WikiLeaks is that it has the same characteristic as the Diebold case, except now it's more sophisticatedly integrated into the traditional mass media. So the first instance of the series of three major attacks of WikiLeaks on the U.S. government was this relatively narrow one. We had the site raise this video, Collateral Murder, which ended up being edited to put the U.S. in a particularly bad light, put on by WikiLeaks.org, in which a Reuters reporter, among others, is seen as being attacked by a U.S. Helicopter. Now, Reuters tried to get this under freedom of information, tried to go through the traditional media of an established organization through established law, getting the material, so the Pentagon Papers model, and failed. WikiLeaks was able to obtain these materials, put them up, but then, in a sophisticated way, used all of the traditional trappings of meeting at the National Press Club, releasing it to the New York Times, etc., to get a lot of traction. Then we saw the Afghan documents and most recently the Iraq War documents, where WikiLeaks plays an even more sophisticated game of giving it to the New York Times, the Guardian, and Der Spiegel so that there's enough exclusivity to create economic incentive to really bump it up, enough diversity so that no single point of failure can be shut down by its government, and a very sophisticated game. But, and this is the but, and my set of questions begins about how robust the democracy and democratizing effects are. A month later, the leaker was jailed. After the Afghan war documents and the Iraq war documents, Assange becomes under public investigation for rape in Sweden. This is the founder and leader. Just at the same day that the Iraq documents were published, New York Times front page has a piece that's very much one that tries to describe Assange as power grabbing, being left by his lieutenants, someone who's too full of himself, right alongside this story. So the question then that we remain with on the table is to what extent this ends up being a robust model, and to what extent we see different systems that that states might bring to bear on distributed individuals who use the fact that they can move from one jurisdiction to another, that they can place their servers in different kinds of jurisdictions to resist censorship on the Diebold model that we saw and now in WikiLeaks, to what extent they're nonetheless susceptible to attack. We don't know yet. We'll see. And we can talk about that later if we want. Essentially, the claim is that if the mass media in the public sphere required very large capital investment in order to speak, essentially either commercial funding or government funding was necessary in order to reach the audience, which also pulled public parties in the direction of money. A lot of media criticism focused on the tension between professional values and corporate values, and citizens were largely passive. And the hope is that what we're seeing is a bit of a pull away from purely monetary and capital controls towards somewhere between more citizens and more room for professional values. So in addition to the New York Times, we now have, just in the last year in terms of Pulitzers, we have ProPublica, a non-profit, highly professional newsroom that whose costs are sufficiently lower than those of a traditional newsroom that it can be sustained on a non-profit model. Similarly, American independent media now has efforts to fund local equivalent newsrooms in local areas. We see foundations. We talked yesterday about the Sunlight Foundation. We talked today about WikiLeaks. The idea is, again, that by leveraging social production, nonprofits can become more effective and more sustainable to a larger extent. We see new high-visibility commercial blogs like Talking Points Memo. We see a new party press like Daily Kos. We'll talk about that in 1 minute. We see citizen journalism, the camera phone footage, what I talked about yesterday with regard to Iran and the BBC as well. Essentially, we're seeing destabilization of the core categories of power: consumer, producers, turns into users, authority, quality, accreditation. All of these were seen to have the proxy of capital as being a proxy for accreditation and authority and reliability, just as we saw yesterday with regard to Britannica versus Wikipedia. I think Judith Miller and the New York Times did a lot to help in destabilizing that belief. And on the other hand, WikiLeaks is doing a lot for the other direction. So you ask yourself today, actually, if Daniel Ellsberg has the Pentagon Papers, does he go to the New York Times or does he go to WikiLeaks? And chances are he'll go to WikiLeaks. It becomes an alternative platform that is more robust, potentially, than the traditional one. So then, let me put on the table one more thing, and that's a skeptical thing. So I spent a lot of time making this case over the last few years, but then recently I finished a study with a colleague, Aaron Shaw, looking at actually the actual practices. So the model of mass-scale participation, Daily Kos, for example, to what extent is it based necessarily on technology, and to what extent is there choice? So we looked at the top 50 or 60 Overall, we looked at 155. About 50 or 60 left and right wing blogs in the U.S. blogosphere is what counts as left and right in the U.S. And what we found was actually quite substantial difference. So if you look at Daily Kos, you've got it uses Drupal, which is a platform that allows for quite extensive user blogs. It has a strong use of user diaries, open threads. It has cultural and organizational model of highly committed users called Rescue Rangers going and looking out at all of the 10,000 or more given active user diaries to find specific things to draw to the front page. So there's fluidity from what users do in their pages to the front page that has about as many people seeing it, if not quite as the New York Times, certainly as the Boston Globe, on any given page. And so you see a combination of technical platform adoption, organization in terms of 20 people on the masthead, 100 people in the inner circle, Rescue Rangers bringing in roughly contributions for about 10,000 active contributors for and about 400,000 registered users. So you see at one level leadership, and one of the claims is this is just a replication of Elite. But on the other hand, you see a very different model. So Instapundit, Glenn Reynolds, not only doesn't use Drupal. Looks like there's something weird in the text. Ignore the text on the side. Pay no attention to the man. comments are turned off. A sole author, essentially making short links to various other news stories as a major player on the left and right wing. So looking at these, we looked on a larger scale, and what we found was that if you look at enhanced platforms like Drupal or Soapblocks, the left adopts them much more widely than the right. If you look at organizational model, whether or not you see a blog that is sole author as opposed to multi-authored, the right has many more sole authored blogs than the left. If you look at large-scale collaboration, by which we defined as over 20 people collaborating, the left much more than the right. If you look at whether or not user blogs, because comments are too thin in order to allow people to actually have a presence over time that's actually stable and them on the site, user blogs other than the main authors. So this reflects how many major main authors there are. This reflects the degree to which non-main authors have a presence on the site that's their own diary or blog. Again, the left significantly more than the right. We looked at flexible content boundaries, by which I mean like Rescue Rangers. Is there a mechanism that's relatively easily available for content produced by users to come to the main page? Or is there sort of background user conversation but no way to come to the front page of the site? Again, the left more than the right. Is there in-depth analysis or just linking? Again, yes, more on the left, less on the right. A lot less confidence in these findings that essentially the left also uses it more, much more for mobilization, calls to action, and fundraising than the right. So why is this? There are all sorts of reasons why this might be. There are stories about what psychologically makes for somebody being a Republican versus a Democrat, which is really all left-right means here, that have to do with authority and hierarchy-seeking versus participation. I suspect, to me, the most likely story is one in which when the blogosphere emerged around 2002-2003, the right largely had its act together in control of government with mass media outlets like Fox News and AM radio, with grassroots mobilization in churches. The left had a lot less. When the blogosphere emerged, it played a much larger role for the left in building its own platforms than the right. But we'll see as we move forward and look at the Tea Party and how it uses, whether these differences turn out to be stable and whether they persist. For our perspective specifically, the reason that I put this here, other than it's cool and new, is here's a context in which blogging software was available at the same time to both of these sites. And yet, it was adopted completely differently. One, in a model that replicates the hierarchical model of a very relatively passive reader, getting told what the news of the day and how to think about it. And the other in a model that actually allows thousands of people a much more participatory role. There's no technological determinism in this. There are patterns of adoption over time. Which one will end up developing will tell us whether we'll end up with a more ideal, open, participatory network public sphere or one that simply replicates what we already have. All of this leaves us with the hopes in 2006 that suddenly the netroots were able to exert power over the party in this particular effort to force safe seats to give their money to the DNC so that they could support competitive races. The very high, everybody talked about how much money was raised online by Obama, but in fact ActBlue raised very large amounts in small donations to competitive districts also in 2008. But at the same time, we have the reality of the White House basically turning around and saying to the same left blogosphere, shut up. And power doesn't reside at the end of the day. And the critical question is how much of power actually resides in the ability to speak and how much of power ends up residing in the ability to control the power of the state. And so we remain with this question of relative effectiveness and the degree to which really the openness shifts power or not. And I think for that, we have a real question. We've all known, as I talked about the Iranian reform movement, about the enormous excitement around the possibility of video. We've seen the Iranian blogosphere as one that the state failed to block extensively. So this happens to be an image done by two colleagues of mine at the Berkman Center on what's visible, the visible blogosphere in Iran. With this being the reformist, this is what's visible and this is what's blocked. So there are efforts of blocking, but they're far from perfect. Combining a range of things, most important in this particular case is that the Iranian internet starts out with a university system rather than is in Saudi Arabia or China through a choke point. But nonetheless, you continue to have, after over a year, stability of the regime. So the question we remain with is we can identify discrete practices that destabilize the old models of control and power. And we can imagine and give case studies of success, effective success in changing the agenda, changing the outcomes. But at the same time, we are also faced with the persistent power of the state and its responsiveness to aggregations of money. And the question that remains for us to study is the degree, and to observe and to try to build, is the degree to which actual effective power can be shifted in these new systems.
So the floor is open. Fire away.
So we're trying to figure out with him what he did in terms of his change. So magnitude is one of the music sites we looked at, he moved. He decided that he experimented some with monthly subscriptions, and what he found out was that people wanted to just pay a flat fee. As opposed to paid per song. And so he continues, once you pay the fee, you continue to have a Creative Commons license, fully digitally copyable content. So getting a subscription continues to be voluntaristic. But in that transition, which only happened in the last few months, he didn't bother to port the entire normative and the ability to have to pick different sites. So we need to go back and interview him and see what he thought, why he thought about that, given that we actually have substantial data that his old system was working. From the perspective of whether it's useful data or not, The fact that we saw such stable levels of contribution over 5 years is to me more powerful than the decision of a person at a certain point to shift his business model and for now, for a few months, he's happy with it. Yeah.
What do you think about the theory when they say with DRM that you don't own the song, but you own the license? You know, when you download music online, there's like a debate that you don't actually own the song, you own the license of the song.
When you say, what do I think about that? What do you mean?
Like, how do you see that? I probably should be more clear. Like, how do you see that affecting the future? Like, with downloading movies online, where it says you don't own the movie, you own the license.
So I think the effort there, I mean, technically from a legal perspective, it's true. What you're getting is a license, not a physical copy. Essentially, what the industry is trying to do, digitization. Before digitization, there was the technical fact that the way in which you needed to communicate information and cultural goods required that you communicate them in some atom container.
Mm-hmm.
So you had copyright law optimized around this idea of the container. And the trade-off between incentives and rent extraction for purposes of investment in cultural production and freedom to use the materials stabilized around what you could do with the copy. So you can get a copy and then you can sell it to someone else. That's the first sale document. You can get a copy and you can cut and paste it and put it up on a... That's a certain kind of fair use and mash. With digitization, two things became possible. Option one is what we saw since Napster, which is massive copying, distribution, etc., and essentially destabilization of the ability to control the copy, and the possible abstraction of the recording industry and direct relations between artists and fans. Not good for the recording industry. Option two, fantastic for the recording industry, the ability to control not a unit, but every use. And charge for every use, not for every unit. So the move to call it a license, not a thing, is the beginning of the effort, or is part of the effort to make sure that you set up a legal environment that allows you to then say, I'll charge you this amount for being able to watch it for 36 hours, that amount for being able to watch it 3 times, the third amount for 10 times. I'll be able to charge you more than that. You can't hand it over to your friends, so the first sale doctrine goes out the window. It's part of an effort to essentially create a legal framework that pushes you more in the direction of perfect ability to price discriminate between different users and uses, rather than having some hard boundary that allows you to transfer the thing and then do whatever you want with at least that particular instance.
Do you think this will fall back to that eventually? I mean, apps, the same thing. On an iPhone, you don't technically own the app, you own the license. So
well, when you say fall back to that, you mean, is
like
that going
music.
To be the stable end?
Like music, what happens with music where a lot of music is no longer DRM? That's what I mean.
So it depends on which system we're going to be in. If we're in a system that runs over proprietary wireless networks, over devices that are heavily proprietary and use proprietary standards, over mobile systems that are not particularly competitive, I can easily see things stabilizing in the direction of a relatively controlled system. If we move towards something that has net neutrality applied to wireless, that has the potential for competition, potentially over Wi-Fi nomadic networks instead of just over proprietary spectrum, it's going to be much harder to maintain that. So essentially, here's a way of abstracting and coming back to the point about multiple systems. I think the stable state, at least for a serious period, depends on a relatively stable settlement between the multiple systems so that they can work. What happened with open systems is that they destabilized the relative comfort with which law and technology allowed cultural goods to be controlled. What's happening now is a possibility for a way in which that model still exists, and it's now embedded in networks that are capable of effectuating it technically. Or we'll move to systems that continue to be open, and the artists and the fans move, or the software developers move to a system where they have a much more open system. Each of those is relatively stable. It's not stable to have a really open system that anybody can do whatever they want with a really controlled cultural production model. And I would be surprised if a really proprietary closed system ended up not trying to pull an open production system and leverage it to create rents for
them. Okay. Thank you very much.
Something that you didn't speak to at all, I think, is the level of, call it skill, call it cultural capital, that is needed to be a player in this new world. And is it not also hierarchical? Is this Ben Harris, someone who's a construction worker, or is it someone with a high level of education, so on?
So there are two kinds of answers to that. The first is that skills continue to be a really important divide between who can and can't participate. I think much more important, when people wrote about digital divide 10 years ago, they were talking much more about the cost of a broadband connection. Some of the most interesting work on this is work that Esther Hargitay at Northwestern has been doing to actually measure skill gaps across SES categories, finding really and persistent skill gaps. The answer used to be, oh, it's just a cohort effect. Wait, all the young people are all really savvy. I think Esther's work has shown that that's not necessarily true, and you continue to see disparities across SES categories, irrespective of age. So that's really important, but it suggests a very targeted intervention in education, which is to say, focus on skills as a core enabling category for democracy, for cultural participation, etc. That's one kind of answer. Another kind of answer is, accepting that, how much is open to who relative to what, essentially? And the relative here is the mass-mediated environment, where the entry barrier to participation was much higher. So if you look at one of the masthead contributors that I sometimes, in order to answer this question, use. There are various contributors. Instead of me reading it, there are various contributors on Daily Cost that you actually read their profile, and you see, this is not your typical op-ed contributor in any shape or form that would make it onto a site that has roughly the circulation of a mid to high level newspaper in the US. And so it's somewhere in between. You do need a skills level, but on the other hand, you're talking about maybe a move from 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people able to reach audiences of hundreds of thousands to the low millions. I don't know, 1, 2, 3 million people more or less. What is that? A percent of the population? Pathetic to call that participation. On the other hand, the difference between 2 or 3 million and a few thousand is a very big one.
Mostly for this participation, you don't need particularly sophisticated computer skills. I mean, the interfaces are so easy now. It takes very little barrier to entry. It takes literacy skills. You have to be articulate. But it's not, that is, the actual digitalized skills are not so great for lots of these forms of participation.
So as it turns out, and this is, I'm mostly relying here on Esther Hargitay's work, it turns out that even what you think of as not particularly sophisticated, knowing what can be done, turns out that there's a real divide.
I would distinguish between an information or a knowledge gap. Some people don't know how, but skills, how long would it take for somebody who decides, I've heard about this blogosphere stuff, I've never seen a computer, I'd like to start doing it, how much training does it take to be able to become a participant?
It's not high skill in that sense,
right,
of long to acquire,
right,
a skill.
So that's why it's not a big skill gap. It's a skill gap that's a real gap that this required programming like it did, you know, 20 years ago.
Undoubtedly.
So
that's true.
I think it's a misdescription to call it a skill gap, in the sense that conveys an idea that there's a real barrier that would require a lot of training.
That's good. But what I am emphasizing is that it turns out that even though the skills are not particularly sophisticated and complex, although again, it depends on what, how much of, when you're talking about writing an entry on daily costs versus producing a watchable mashup, those are two very different levels of skill. I'm not saying just putting something together. Putting something that's watchable is non-trivial. So there's a range, and depending on what you're emphasizing as the important aspect, the critical finding is that there is a persistent, even across ages, gap in terms of important class distinctions.
Building on this, and going back to the conversation that you and I had right before the beginning of the talk, having to do with the crisis in mass media or conventional media, isn't it the case that much of what you see on the internet is opinion, and it isn't so much actual generation of investigative reporting that requires a great deal more capital and professional training and long-term investment of time, really? And to what degree is the viability of the internet as a vehicle for actually compensating for the crisis of the conventional media actually? It's suffering because much of what it does do is just circulate things that it gets out of the conventional media.
The spirit of Bob McChesney floating over Madison.
Yes.
So, I don't have a quantitative answer. Nobody does. But just today's stories suggest at least a qualitative answer, which is to say, who found the mistakes in the Diebold system? It was not someone who was in the traditional model of mass media. It was the fact that it was distributed, the fact that it was hard, meant that a professional security, that an academic security center was able to identify it, create a distributed peer review system that said, yes, these are valid problems, directly to the state. The same for the emails, it wasn't even that. It was basically just people persistently reading the emails saying this is important. So that's a system. For WikiLeaks, do you disagree that the next Ellsberg goes to WikiLeaks and not to the New York Times? The answer is WikiLeaks. Now, where's the funding from WikiLeaks? WikiLeaks, last time I was able to look at it, though I need to try to update the numbers, about $600,000 per year for server space raised from donations.
Right, but where did WikiLeaks take the information?
From a whistleblower.
No, I mean, where did it take it to? Who did they then distribute it to?
They distributed it to a very small number, but you asked a different question. You asked about the investigation, not about the salience. What they did was they used the cultural habits left over from the 20th century that what's important is what the New York Times says, which come from a period where capital stands for authority and credibility, and manipulated those to force them to project what came out of an investigative process that was decentralized. When I talked yesterday about the Sunlight Foundation and the investigative journalism about which member of Congress paid from their campaign funds, what did you have? You had a nonprofit building a platform that mashed together several public data sites based on government-required data, but each of them produced by a different nonprofit, harnessing decentralized citizens to mesh the data from multiple of these to get the investigative journalism. Who did that? A nonprofit foundation leveraging decentralized innovation. When I talked about Pork Busters yesterday, same exact model. When I mentioned ProPublica today, the Pulitzer Prize on the reporting, again, that's a non-profit model, but a highly professional non-profit model that is able to lower its costs by doing things online. So my answer is there are new economic conditions under which some combination of professional and non-professional, commercial and non-commercial, are developing to use the new affordances to provide the same set of watchdog functions. And the concern over the loss of the traditional media is a concern that comes from looking backwards for the solutions as they used to be under conditions where there was no option but to have someone who could afford the millions of dollars that it took to produce a paper. And then they became the anchor of authority. But that's no longer the model. It's not the model in software. It's not the model in encyclopedias. It's not the model in music. It's not the model in video entertainment. And it's not going to be the model in news either.
On one of these projects, they seem to have a central figure. So, I mean, let's say Wikipedia has Jimmy Webb, the new Linux has Stallman and Kellogg's, and yada yada, Wikileaks has Assange. And I'm wondering, it seems that there's this figure that's representing the organization at the top of the organization. So I'm wondering, I mean, and in the case of Assange, and you put it to New York Times article, kind of pictures of his power grabbing and very controlling. So I'm wondering if this relation between these open organizations and leadership, do you find that the kind of leadership or the kind of control they have is as a danger to network information economy and network hubs here? And a second question is, do you think that this kind of big name attached to it will change with the development of network?
Hard questions. I think also even hard to really separate out the difference between what's genuinely critical about the leadership role and what's just described that. So if you look at Wikipedia, Wikipedia hasn't really been run by Jimmy Wales in years. Right? It's a complex democratic structure with a lot of local authority around different articles, with a good bit of now, there may or may not be power abuse cases, there's lots of arguments one way or the other, but they're not about Jimmy Wales. The stories continue to be about Jimmy Wales, but that's a way of looking at that. But the truth is, you do have a role for individuals who are actually pulling things ahead and for leadership. And trying to characterize exactly that role and the degree to which people lead a process can actually commit to the community, not to undermine them or not. I think we have a whole field to study about the natural life of these organizations and the relationship between how much leadership helps and how much it undermines, how dangerous it is, how not dangerous it is. My own intuition is that once people understand the value of something like the WikiLeaks or the Diebold model. If tomorrow WikiLeaks were taken down because of the attack that attacked the United States, the three attacks upon the United States in the last few months, someone else will come up. The model is there. It may also then be that there's an individual who sort of coalesces, or a small group of people, which may have more to do with the internal social dynamics of what gets people motivated and mobilized and coordinated. But that's different than saying it's critical that there be a particular kind of personality that's more or less dangerous in a particular kind of form. And I'd be more resistant until better evidence to that particular theory, if that's the theory.
I'm
going to
go back to the journalism question for a moment. Clearly, there are cases in which peer-produced journalism, particularly where there's distributed processing involved, WikiLeaks, Sunlight Foundation, and so on, play a really important role and a critical role, so I'm not even beginning to question that. And that's opened up a new significant space, particularly in the realm of what we might call broadly investigative journalism. So, no question about that. But I'm still wondering whether there's a gap here in the production of journalism, what we might call curated journalism, separating the function of curation from authority, which you may or may not agree that we ought to do. Curated journalism as a public good that is systematically underproduced both by the market and by peer production. And so I believe that we're entering into a period like that, so that effectively there's a major gap in the sort of curation, the investigation, narration function, especially at the less so at the national level, where peer production from below can feed into very high-profile, highly organized and scalable producers of journalistic articles that draw from journalistic authority at the national level. But at the local level, for example, even in extremely robust communication ecologies like Seattle, for example, where there's tremendous peer production across the entire domain, there's probably more peer production of what we might call news there than any place else. But most of that news is not, I would argue, of the same quality and the same focus, same civic focus as traditional journalism. It's a public good. It's being systematically underproduced. So do you think that, A, that that isn't a public good, that it's not being systematically underproduced, that we won't need that form of public good in the future, and essentially that peer production can serve as a substitute for it in the long run, not simply in national aggregated ecologies, but particularly in sort of local and regional ecologies?
So first of all, I want to extract from that the set of things that we agree on to make them clear.
Okay.
One is that we're going to see an ecology in which you have some national and international players. New York Times, BBC, Al Jazeera, who actually have very large audiences. We're seeing now Der Spiegel creating an English language, Corriere della Sera, Le Monde, moving towards global audiences at that high level. And that all of these various models that I talked about work, and we have a particular problem in regional reporting. Now, hyperlocal is also very interesting. It looks as though hyperlocal papers that have supermarket inserts continue to actually be very viable on the old model, just because it's very hard to send very, very hyperlocal supermarket inserts elsewhere, at least in the US. That seems to be a model that continues to work. So you really are talking about a mid-level... what used to be a mid-level regional paper.
Metropolitan.
A metropolitan paper. Now, that's legitimate as a concern, but it's a much, much more specific target of problem than what Patrick was raising, which I think is more generally raised in the concern about the future of journalism. And because it's narrower, I think it's also susceptible to a more discrete solution. Which is to say, if you identify that that's the particular area of interest, then that's where you could put either public funding, non-profit funding, one of these other non-market sources, if you think that the bottom has fallen out of the market, as I think many people have thought. So that, when I focused on American independent media, that's the one non-profit that has this particular approach of, at this point, I think in 11 different places, funding very specifically to fill that empty niche. And if it's correct that that's the place that the problem is in, then at least it's a defined problem, not one that we need to resolve the whole media ecology. We just need to solve that one problem. I don't have good evidence that that's not a problem. So I'm perfectly willing to live with the idea that that's a problem that needs to be solved. But as long as that's the discrete problem, it's a much more solvable problem by any of the traditional non-market models than solving all of the watchdog function, all of the media, all of them.
So I think we should close. We can carry on the discussion, as I said, around a fire, which I think is well needed this evening, and a fire with mulled cider and wine and goodies at my house at 7:30. And tomorrow at 12:20 in the Haven Center, 8108 Social Science. So thank you.